The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Of course, one of the biggest stories of the past almost 2 years has been the horrific humanitarian situation in Gaza, which just seems to get worse on a daily basis. The death toll has now passed 57,000, according to health authorities in the enclave. It's a great pleasure now joining us on the Pat Kenny Show live in studio to welcome the global spokesperson for UNICEF, James Elder, whose office is in Geneva, but only 2 weeks ago was in Gaza to see firsthand the horrors at the feeding stations and elsewhere. You're very welcome to the programme, James. Maybe you might start by outlining what you saw on your most recent visit.
Yeah, thanks, Ivan. I mean, as you rightly say, things deteriorate every day. It's quite extraordinary. The two things that struck me most is the water deprivation. It's one thing to constantly hear these false claims made by Israel of depriving a population of food because, you know, as I say, of what are unsubstantiated claims around aid diversion, and then at the same time, but water, you know, denying people sufficient access to water is both illogical and another grave breach of humanitarian law. So I've been seeing the stress on communities. If you've got malnutrition spiking and now in the middle of summer, everyone having being below an emergency level of water. And that's, again, that's a purely political decision. It's not logistical. You fix that in 24 hours. So that was something. Then, of course, these aid distribution sites, the militarized sites, was something that shocked because of both all the mass casualty events, but as well, trying to sideline a humanitarian system. And Ivan, honestly, in terms of what I saw this time around, it was also what I heard. I'm uncomfortably familiar now with walking through hospitals in Gaza, across girls and boys, three children to a bed, across children lying on the floor with grave wounds of war, with shrapnel in their head, with amputations that will occur. This time I didn't just see those girls and boys. Ivan, I heard them. There's such a lack of painkillers there that you talk to families and you sit there with the screams of their children as the noise surrounding you, because girls and boys with those wounds don't have access to the painkillers that they need.
And each night on our TV screens, we see just more horror piled on top of horror as hospitals can't function and so on. Just focusing on the aid question. So originally there was a UN-backed UMRA system, was it, that provided aid? And this was replaced by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which was an Israeli-American system. First of all, just tell us how long that's in place, you know, when the blockade started, because, you know, the violence, you know, is going on since October, 12 months. So just tell us about the old system versus the new system.
Yeah, it's a great question. I want the old system, firstly, is the system that's been in place since the end of World War II. So in, you know, countless war zones and conflict zones, Gaza is not the first place that the UN's worked where there's a lack of governance and it's a, you know, it's an active conflict site. This is what humanitarian workers are experienced in doing. But if we just go back 2 months during the ceasefire, 500 to 600 trucks a day of humanitarian and commercial goods, 400 distribution points. And that's key. What humanitarian aid is about going to where people need it, particularly in a war zone where you've got the elderly, where you've got people who've had their family killed, where you've got a lot of wounded. So 400 distribution points. UNICEF at times were going door to door to serve those malnutrition cases that we'd been tracking. And based on 400 distribution points, we saw very quickly a recovery. We saw malnutrition going down. We saw access to water increasing, saw disease going down. Then in a stated aim, not my supposition, a stated aim to push a population to the south, there was an attempt to sideline that. It's often an attempt made with false statements talking about, you know, aid diversion. We've asked for evidence relentlessly on aid diversion. It's never been presented to us. International Crisis Group has said that less than 1% of aid is diverted, which would make it less than, you know, Somalia, Afghanistan back in the day. So there's no evidence to it. And so there's four sites now. You have four sites. They are militarized, which means that civilians must go through a conflict zone to get to them, which means now we've had between 15 and 20 casualty events of those where people have been shot, or I've seen children, Ivan, with shrapnel wounds from tanks when they've simply gone to get food for their family. So you have a scenario now where people are being starved in various parts of the Gaza Strip, given access to 4 points and 4 points only. And to access it, they have to go through a conflict site where we've seen multiple mass casualty events. And at the end of the day, you are not serving the population most in need. It's the same people who go all the time. It's not the elderly. I've had elderly women in tears to me saying, James, how will I go to this place? It's increasingly, it's young guys. It's often armed with knives. They take, you know, sugar and cooking oil, which is worth money, put it on the black market. And the vast majority of the population is seeing nothing because, again, four sites versus 400. And, of course, as UNICEF keeps making clear to authorities, humanitarian aid is much more than food. It's
and surely it suited the Israelis to have the NGOs doing this. I mean, why did they want to get rid of the NGOs? I know there was a particular allegation about some of the humanitarian staff were members of Hamas and it was being diverted, allegedly some of the food. But surely from the point of view of keeping the lid on the situation and trying to manage it, it suited the Israeli and the IDF to leave it as it was. Why change it?
Look, it's difficult for me in my mandate, Ivan. There are allegations, and these are allegations that part of the ambition is creating chaos in the Gaza Strip. There is no functional law and order that exists there. Certainly a deprivation of water. I would ask that too. It's so simple. You turn on the taps. Everything is controlled through Israel, whether water pipelines or electricity for desalination plants. Why would you deprive a population of water? There are stated positions from senior officials about pushing a population to the south. So using aid, as the Secretary General has said, using aid as bait for a population. There were severe allegations over the weekend in Israeli newspapers about various people saying there are no civilians in Gaza. So the injuries I've seen and the horrors I've seen at those sites speak to anything but humanitarianism. It has no functional purpose of that. Humanitarianism also is very much around data, about seeing what works, making sure that you know malnutrition's going down, making sure you've got an evidence base. We are seeing absolutely none of that there. So it's hard to speak to the clear intent, but certainly the evidence of 2 months ago in terms of what works with humanitarian aid, 500 trucks a day and 400 sites, and you see a game changer there. And it is important, Ivan, too, if we look at looting, firstly, you know, looting is the economics of scarcity. Looting is if you have Dublin and you allow nothing in it for 90 days other than bombs, and then you send in two trucks down the same route, it's a roadside distribution. People will take what they need, it'll go. But so at this point, we're having people being starved and then being blamed, you know, for scrambling for survival. It's horrendous the way that the people are pushed, the limits they're pushed to. Having said that, I see time and again communities and grandparents trying to instill all the same qualities that they hold dear, despite every aspect of their society, education, the economy, all being under attack.
Now, I watched the 7 o'clock Channel 4 news, which has showed a lot of videos of these incidents at the four feeding stations, where the IDF seemed to open fire randomly on these people desperately seeking aid. What exactly is going on there? I mean, why would they do that? Because, you know, and each time they say, well, they're investigating it and half denying it. How does that serve Israeli purposes?
Investigating, it's difficult, isn't it? We hear that all the time, that you know, we're learning from this. But, I mean, it's we're not looking at a learning curve. We're looking at a pattern of impunity. And unfortunately, that's very clear. And unfortunately, I mean, that's very clear to Palestinians in Gaza, who many of them articulate things very brilliantly, who I will often explain, particularly because I've, you know, as you know, had a lot of time with this show and Irish press, and it's very clear to people around the world that the Irish people are top of the tree in caring about this issue. And I will often explain to Palestinians that because I want them to know that they're heard. And they will often also respond, yes, James, we understand, but we also know international humanitarian law doesn't apply to us. And that's a horrendous thought, or as a young...
Why?
Well, I think they're clearly aware of the realities going on. They know what international humanitarian law is, that, you know, you cannot kill reportedly 17,000 children. You cannot destroy or damage 85...
So are you referring to the sort of global political indifference? Is that...
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That there has been, yes, that Israel is well aware that it's acted with impunity and has been allowed to do so and still allowed to do so. So to answer your question, why would they do that? There was a single family I met. One of the daughters in there said to me in perfect English, James, starvation is just so humiliating to go with a tin every night. Her brother went to one of these sites. All the family tried to encourage him not to, but People are starving. You want to help your mum. You're seeing your mum depressed because she's seeing what's happening to her children. And he went and he explained it to me, and I've heard this more than 10 times, Ivan. He went and he got corralled into, as he said, like a cattle pen, sat there for 4 hours from around 8 p.m. to midnight. Then at midnight, a drone came over. And in his words, then people around me were shot from a drone. And he said, James, we were sitting exactly where we were told. Why would they do that? That was his question. Why would they do it? So, I mean, there would be answers to that, not mine to share. But what is terrifying is, as we talk of all these things, somehow, Ivan, you know, 17,000, I looked at it the other day, 17,000 girls and boys reportedly killed since the horrors of October 7. I tried to break that down. That is now a child, a girl or a boy killed every single hour since October 7, every single hour. So if it happened in Ireland, 168 kids killed in a week, imagine the outcry. Again, this is a bad example because the Irish care. Many other countries, we've normalised so much. So it's been normalised what's happened at these GHF sites. It's normalised attacks on hospitals. It's normalised attacks on schools. And now somehow it's normalised that there's a deathly deprivation of water to people.
Now, the latest development on the NGO charity side is that 170 charities have come together publicly calling for the aid distribution scheme to revert to what it was away from this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the Israeli method, which has proven patently to be such a disaster in every respect. So what exactly are the charities calling for?
I think they're making it very clear to return to what was working. This is what's so frustrating. I've had well-meaning journalists say to me, look, but isn't it better than nothing? But it's a false equivalent. The alternative is not nothing. The alternative is 400 distribution sites done by humanitarians. Remembering, while the GHF is functioning, whilst, you know, you're having at least 15 of these casualty events and absolute chaos and elderly and injured and single mums having no access whatsoever, you know, you are not serving the most vulnerable. UNICEF, for example, we will still, as I did in the north, you know, doing a distribution for severely malnourished children to their mums and to their grandmothers. We are still running water systems. We are still doing, you know, education classrooms, all these things that go on every single day. There are no injuries at these things. There's no one's killed at these things. Firstly, because they don't happen in conflict sites. You must do humanitarian aid in a deconflicted site. And secondly, because, of course, you have the trust of the community. So I think what those NGOs are calling for, which is so straightforward, but being deliberately made murkier, is allow humanitarian aid to do what it did 2 months ago in Gaza, what it did in Afghanistan, Ukraine, Somalia, Sudan, what it does everywhere. And I think there's a critical point here going even beyond Gaza, Ivan, which is obviously this is making a situation much, much worse for civilians. You know, to see little boys killed simply going to get food for their father, the pain that is for a dad to know that your son, your 13-year-old son, as the boy I met, Abed al-Rahman, was killed getting food for his family. But if we can even go beyond that, the precedent this may set, if we are now, we're seeing many precedents set in Gaza, if we now get to a point where in the next war zone, one of the warring parties can decide, okay, so we don't need the United Nations to deliver it. We do it. We choose who gets aid. We choose who gets monitored. We choose who we shoot. And we choose who we feed. That is yet another terrifying precedent that could come out of this conflict.
So on top of the violence and the shooting and the bombings and the 57,000 dead, since about mid-May, the situation changed in terms of the humanitarian relief. And I assume it's very hot there this time of year. You speak about water. Have people actually died of malnutrition and famine? You know, because the weeks are elapsing now.
Yes, unfortunately, absolutely. We know of scores of children who've died of malnutrition, because we're often asked that. The critical thing to remember with malnutrition is the vast majority of children who are severely malnourished die of a simple childhood illness. They'll die of dysentery, dirty water, rather. They'll get a simple waterborne disease. Any one of a basic childhood illnesses that would never kill a child makes it 10 times more likely. So that is happening. But as we've now seen, there's 100 children going in for treatment, UNICEF says, every day this year. So now you have that, and you're somehow combining a lack of nutritional food with a lack of water. Those two are utterly, utterly catastrophic. And again, these are just political decisions. So yes, we're seeing children die from purely malnutrition or starvation, would be a less technical term. Most of them die of something else. We don't know the numbers. What's horrifying, Ivan, there's a hospital in the south called Nasser Hospital. It's the only functioning hospital, serves 1 million people. Yesterday, for example, I saw a note from the director of that hospital hospital, they no longer have wound dressing. They don't have wound dressing. They only deal with trauma victims. So if you are a parent whose child is malnourished or child is so horrendously sick with, you know, with diarrhea and so on and cannot keep fluids, you don't go to that hospital, A, because they're only dealing with trauma, and B, because they're in an evacuation site. To get to Nasser Hospital, you have to go through a conflict site, meaning you are, I don't know what the word is, fair game. It's not appropriate. But so the chances of people with children who are very unwell getting to hospital are very remote. And now if you do get to Nasser Hospital, they have run out of dressing wound. That, again, is something that's been denied entry into Gaza.
Now, the international community's response. Over the months, I think it's fair to say that Spain and Ireland and maybe Belgium and Slovenia were outliers within the EU27. But there was a summit last week and there seemed to be some movement in reviewing the EU-Israeli agreement and pact. The difficulty being that you require unanimity and there were 9 states, including Austria and Germany, that weren't going to agree. Do you see, after all the interviews you've done, as the situation gets worse, after all the media highlighting this issue, do you see any movement in the international community coming to bear on Israel?
Yes, because of what you said, because of that EU-Israel action plan, it's so, so critical. It's so critical that Palestinians feel that there is that action. Is it moving? As you rightly say, it needs everyone's support. We saw strong statements out of key member states, United Kingdom, France, Canada recently. Now, of course, member states have many other tools in their arsenal beyond statements, so we need to see that. It's not mine to give up hope. Certainly, what I noticed, which was remarkable, Ivan, I wasn't there for the ceasefire, but everyone told me during the ceasefire, within day one, cappuccinos and cake and a supermarket with salmon and so on. I thought they were teasing me. This is the ability Palestinians have to bounce back based on one of the highest literacy rates in the world and based on obviously what they've endured for 20, 30, 40 years. This is not new to them. But is enough being done? No. And for that, I think there is such an argument in principle and practice that more should be. I quote here, Ivan, I met a young Palestinian poet, Noor. She's only in her 20s. So many poets here. It's quite remarkable how many young people have that eloquence. And she said, almost verbatim, one day maybe history will tell our story. Maybe they will say they didn't know, but we know the truth. They knew. They all knew. And they chose to look away.
But my question was, do you detect movement in the international community or are you more hopeful now? And that brings me on to the other question that Trump has said that Israel have agreed with him to do a 60-day ceasefire and a deal with Hamas and so on. Are you optimistic of a ceasefire?
I spent most of 2024 seeing hopes absolutely dashed. And in Gaza, that's brutal. That's a mother feeling the sense that we're getting a ceasefire deal and promising her daughter that she'll wake up tomorrow morning with no bombs and seeing that blown away. So the evidence base is unfortunately not great on that, if you think about how many false dawns we've got to. At the same time, an organisation like UNICEF we have political sway behind closed doors, but on a ceasefire, you know, it's certain governments speaking here. So all we do is get ready, and that's what we are doing. So we've done it before and had false dawns, but in terms of getting our preparations ready again to get hundreds of those trucks in, nutrition supplies, repair water systems, the full name of the game, get shelter in for 700,000 people who've newly displaced. In that sense, we are planning for a ceasefire. Will everyone in Gaza be lethally disappointed again? I don't know.
Finally, James, Ireland and Irish people, and I've been at many events. There were fundraisers for UNICEF, and Peter Power has done a great job here, as well as your other staff. If people want to assist, is there any call to action from UNICEF in Ireland to the public?
Thank you. I think there's two things. And one is, and I genuinely mean this, no one has a stronger voice than the Irish, and no one, Ivan, is more recognised in Ireland. It's the only place I've ever been in Gaza where I've travelled with Irish people and thought about maybe I'll just change my nationality, seeing the love that the Irish get from Palestinians. So the voice still matters, absolutely. And as you say, in those political forums. Second thing is, even during a blockade like now, UNICEF does cash to 750,000 people. It is a game changer. Cash allows a family to go and buy overpriced baby formula. It allows family to go and buy horrendously overpriced some sort of produce or flour that exists if you can afford to pay 10 times the price. That cash to 750,000 people literally is a lifesaver. And it doesn't require, you know, it doesn't require us to get approval for trucks going in. So yes, any people's fiscal generosity goes straight into the hearts and stomachs of Palestinians.
It's true, the main UNICEF.com is there, or what's the best route?
Look, UNICEF Ireland.
UNICEF Ireland.
Yeah.
Just Google that and you will find a way to support them. Well, look, I want to thank you, first of all, coming. You're based in Geneva. You are the global spokesperson for UNICEF. We're honoured to have you on the Pat Kenny Show. We hope that your efforts will bear fruit, politically and in terms of a humanitarian breakthrough for the feed and water distribution. James Elder, thank you.
Thanks so much, Ivan.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.